Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're doing things a bit differently this week. Now, walk around any city in the world and you will most likely see pigeons, crows, some blackbirds and maybe a seagull trying to rob your chips. We take these animals and the fact that they can actually fly completely for granted. It's incredible when you think about it, but it's equally incredible to think at one time there weren't any animals that could fly at all. So what happened? Well, Lev Parikian is a conductor and author of Taking Flight, the evolutionary story of life on the wing. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Lev. This is, I suppose, an interesting one because we've just taken flight for granted, but at some point there were no flying things. Do we know when that was?
We do. Thanks for having me on. Yes, and that thing you said about taking it for granted was really the impetus for my writing this book. I realised that something I'd taken for granted all my life, even though I'm a big fan of birds. And it made me delve into the history of it. And I discovered that, yes, the first flying fossil we have is an insect from about 325 million years ago. We don't know how it evolved from before that, because this thing that we have, it's called Delicharla bitterfeldensis, and it's beautiful, sort of mayfly, dragonfly-like wings, but they're fully formed wings. So we don't have anything from before that that shows what might have been, you know, a half a wing or how those wings developed in insects, which were the first things to fly. So there's the fossil records are a curious thing. I've likened it in the book to imagine you're watching a film and you only see, you know, the projectionist decides to show you just half a second every 8 minutes or so. I'm not sure, you know, how accurate that analogy is, but it works for me in thinking of how fragmentary the fossil record is. So there's been a lot of conjecture and deduction going on by people who've studied these things. And it's a fascinating story from those beginnings.
So do we not have any, because there's lots of different types of flying, right? I mean, insects and birds and bats, they all fly, they can fly very differently. Presumably, this ability was evolved in different periods in time. Do we have a number of how many different types of flight evolved? Like, did because there's so many different wings and everything. Like,
that's
did
right.
all insect fly? Did all insect flight evolve together, or was there 50 different ways of evolving insect flight? What about bats? What about pterosaurs?
It was kind of sequential. So it evolved, as you've sort of said there. It's evolved in four groups. Insects were the first. And then pterosaurs came along. They're the first vertebrates to fly. And shortly, I say shortly, but you know, a few million years later, the birds, some dinosaurs became what we call birds and evolved it. And then the last ones to evolve are our closest relatives, flying relatives, the bats. It didn't happen immediately, but once it took hold, let's take the insects, for example, that first insect 325 million years ago, from there were all sorts of adaptations made by different groups of insects, and that came over, again, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years. And so you get from those basic first wings, those first flyers would have been something like the mayflies and dragonflies we have now, just very easy. Intuitive mechanism of muscle pulls down on wing, other muscle pulls up on wing, repeat sometimes per second. And there were insects that took these mechanisms and made it more sophisticated. So then there's the indirect flight mechanism, which really squeezes the body of the insect, flexes, and the muscles are triggered and set off by that, so that this mechanism, which can go much faster.
What sort of insects are those then?
Well, nearly all of them, actually, these days. A good at least 75%, I think it is, of insects use that method. So, you know, flies, beetles, butterflies, and so on, they'll all use that that way of doing it, which gives you a higher upper limit on the speed of the wing beats. So you get fruit flies and so on, and little gnats and midges that can go up to 1,000 beats a second, some of them, which is
wow,
yeah, extraordinary. But even think about the honeybee, which is one of the most sort of visible and well-known of insects, that probably manages something like 200 beats per second. So we're talking about speeds and scale that is kind of beyond human comprehension in some ways. But there were the other adaptations that were made. For example, I deal with the beetles, which is it's the largest group. There's more than 400,000 species of the things, and quite bewildering numbers. And they have been so successful because they evolved one pair of their wings into these protective coverings called elytra, which they, if you look at a ladybird, for example, you can see that that sort of carapace. And those originally would have been wings. And now when they fly, they just use one pair of wings and then they hold out these elytra, which kind of just hang there. But their main use is to protect them so that they can burrow down into under the wood or into the soil or whatever. So that was really useful for when there were, you know, for example, a fire in their area. They could burrow down away from it, and that way they diversified and, you know, helped them survive better than other things.
So do we know how these different types of flight evolved? Like what steps got birds to flight? Because as you say, that the fossil record is quite patchy. You know, do we see, you know, pre-flight birds that have appendages that were used for something else that then ended up being useful for flight?
Those are the hypotheses, aren't they? So there's various things. So you're looking at these, going into birds there, you've got these dinosaurs that would, we now know, the theropod dinosaurs, to which the T-Rex belongs, for example. And they would have, it's thought now, they developed these basic feathers, which they might have used to keep them warm, or they might have, the more advanced ones might have been used as some sort of display of sexual selection, for example. Mm. And so those feathers will have covered their forelimbs, and those forelimbs would have over time developed into wings. Now, how exactly that happened has been a subject of great conjecture. And there, for a long time, there were two basic hypotheses. Intuitively, the ground up hypothesis and the trees down. So you can sort of, from the names, you can guess how those work. The ground up would be, it would start running and maybe start flapping to jump to catch an insect. And the ones that could jump a little bit higher or maybe glide a bit to help catch whatever the prey was would be favored in selection.
Yeah.
Therefore, that would develop and there you are, you have a flyer. And the other one, the trees down hypothesis, has a slightly less active beginnings in a kind of gliding thing going on. And again, it's to the ones that could glide further or even extend their flight with a bit of flapping would have been favoured by selection.
Right. So are they difficult to explore experimentally? Because evolutionary biology is, you know, it gets a bad rap at times because people are kind of going, well, this probably happened, but proving things is difficult. There's a guy you talk about in the book called Ken Dial. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
Yeah, he was interesting. So he was looking at these two hypotheses and thinking, well, there's problems with both of them. So he had observed young partridge chicks, so young birds that had not fully developed flight yet, but have wings that they will use to help them. And he developed this third hypothesis called the wing-assisted incline running. The acronym is WARE. Wing-assisted incline running. So you could guess that is something running up a slope, and it uses these little wings, which aren't yet fully developed for flight, to help it go up the slope a little bit quicker. And so he did an experiment, and he got these partridges running up slopes of, you know, you got a board and chase them up it and change the angle of the slope and measured to what extent they were using their wings or not, as the case may be.
Right.
And so from that, he saw that, and, you know, also noticed that in times of danger, these things will run up a tree. You know, so that was based on real life observations from today and applying that to what might have happened with, you know, a reasonable expectation of probability over 150 million years or so ago. So with things like that, we are able to conjecture and to work out more or less what might have happened from things we know today. One of the second group after insects to develop flight, the pterosaurs, they're rather difficult to experiment on because there aren't more. So with that field, there's a lot of conjecture, partly because for them the fossil record is also extremely sparse, and so you have these fragments. They've got very thin bones, so that would make
Do they have hollow bones, pterosaurs?
Yeah. So
kind of hollow bones, very common in flight, obviously. But how? I mean, how big? Because these, like, actually getting your head around the size of these pterosaurs. It gives you an idea of how incredible they were. So how wide and how heavy were they? Because we associate flight with, you know, really light things, but these creatures were enormous.
Absolutely. It's extraordinary, isn't it? They weren't all enormous, just to say that at the beginning. The very first one we have is from about 230 million years ago, and that was about the size of a woodpecker. But as they developed, and there were quite a few that were small and agile and doing that kind of hunting in the air thing by swooping around, much like swallows and swifts and martins today. But as time went on, they did the tendency, or the general tendency of size was bigger. And by the time you get to the late Cretaceous, around 70 million years ago, you've got things in the air that were mind-bogglingly huge. If you imagine a giraffe and add wings, that's the kind of size we're talking about. This is a thing called Quetzalcoatlus northropi. And another one called Hatzegopteryx, which not exactly snappy names. I mean, if we had pterosaurs nowadays, we'd probably have folk names for them. So they'd be slightly less scientific and rather more intuitive, like huge guy, you know.
That's if you let the physicist name the pterosaurs. but do we know how on earth they managed to evolve? Because that sounds extremely energy intensive from an evolutionary point of view to develop, you know, flight. Why and how did they manage to do something like that without feathers?
Well, I think one of those things is that there was a niche for it, so they it was available to them, and they managed to do it. I mean, we're talking, just to return to the actual size, the wingspan, it's reckoned, of those two species is around 11 metres, which is half a cricket pitch. It's three times broader than the largest wingspan of any bird today, which is the wandering albatross. It's 3.5 or so meters. And the weight, there was a huge debate, has been, and there's, you know, about the actual weight of them. And some conjectures had them absurdly light, which was the only way they could explain how they flew. But I think the general consensus these days is something like 200, 250 kilograms, which is still pretty darn big. Wow. But when you think that they have these incredibly light bones, they would have had these membranes. You try and picture it, they have these extraordinarily long fourth fingers of their hands. So the bone of the fourth finger is something that, you know, you might get a ping pong ball out from behind a radiator with, if you see what I mean. But that from that hangs, would have hung this membrane, which would have been both light and strong. And that's the absolute, the crucial thing, isn't it? It's the combination of lightness and strength. You can develop muscles to get yourself into the air, but those muscles add weight. So you have to, all flying creatures have to tread this balance, this line of being very light and being very strong.
You have something that size, and then, you know, trying to understand how it took flight. Well, it's difficult for me. Because did it have to jump off cliffs, or
that was what it was thought for quite a while. But I think the most recent thinking, looking at not just the fossils but their trackways, is that they would have launched quadrupedally, so they'd be crouched down on all fours. And the difference here between birds and pterosaurs, and one of the reasons it would help them be so efficient, was that they had these very strong forelimbs. So you're using those forelimbs for launching and for flying. And the hind limbs are less developed. In birds, their forelimbs are wings, And their hind limbs are often quite powerful, which help them launch. But then once they're in the air, they're not using those legs for very much. So the advantage that those pterosaurs would have had would have been that those limbs were serving two purposes. And so that would have been a saving.
It would have been one hell of a sight, wouldn't it?
Extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
Over the high street. But also, yeah. I think once they're in the air, they have great aerodynamic capabilities, and those larger ones would have been, it's likely they would have been very good at soaring, so they might have been ocean going, and they might have been travelling really quite a long way, and using the air currents. Possibly in a similar way to those ocean-going birds we have today, like albatrosses.
Very quickly, on our closest relative, the flying mammals that are bats, they're such an outlier in so many ways, how long they live, the fact that they are mammals and they fly. Is the way they fly and the way they develop flight very different to the pterosaur?
Well, again, we've got this rather inconvenient hole in the fossil record. Bat bones don't fossilize very readily. Again, it's the delicacy of them, I think, that is part of the problem. So there seem to be quite a lot of fragments, but not that many complete skeletons. So again, we're not exactly sure how the flight might have developed, but the one conjecture is that you've got something that would have been sitting in a tree, grabbing insects from its perch as they fly by, and gradually extending its reach. And there's also echolocation plays its part in this as well. But what they have managed to do, again, a little bit like pterosaurs, they have these membranes, obviously. But the difference there between the pterosaur and the bat anatomy, the bat hand has exactly the same anatomy as the human hand.
Which is crazy when you see an X-ray of a bat and you realize,
fantastic.
There's our fingers.
There's our fingers, and they're extended. They're very slender, and they're extended through the membrane right to the tips. And with that, of course, they can, if you imagine your own hand with those long fingers like Edward Scissorhands, but with this very thin and flexible membrane in between it, shot through with thin muscles, imagine the flexibility you can get with that and the maneuverability. Using that. So it's a slightly different order to what birds have, where most birds' wings are kind of less maneuverable, even though, of course, they have, with feathers, they're the ultimate evolution of lightness and strength, and also protecting from the elements and keeping them warm and all sorts of things.
So when you think about it, it's an extraordinary thing that we don't really think about a lot, this ability to fly, and that it is in itself something so beautiful to watch. If you spend a moment to watch how birds or animals or even bats, if you're lucky to see one in the evening, how they fly. This book tracks 14 different animals to try and explore the evolution of flight and how animals manage to take from the land to the air. The book is called Taking Flight, and the author there is Lev Parikian. Lev, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Jonathan.
Now, you might have heard of the concept of a digital twin, a digital model of a real-world thing that you can use for testing and simulations without breaking the real one. They're everywhere, from Formula One to factories and buildings, and now babies. Professor Inés Tille is a principal investigator of the Molecular Systems Physiology Group at the University of Galway, and she's principal investigator with APC Microbiome Ireland. She joins me now. Is that right, that sort of description of a digital twin? What exactly is a digital twin, Inés?
So a digital twin is a computational representation of a system, like you said, that might surround us. And in the case of a digital baby, we have now created a computational representation of the metabolism that takes place in a newborn and an infant that we can use for different interrogation for nutritional recommendation and medical applications.
Okay, so this is a digital model, not of the entire baby, but just of the metabolic system. Can you tell me where that starts and where that ends and where you get that information from to make this model?
So maybe I start with the second question. So we obtained the information from biochemical textbooks and also scientific publications really from the last 60, 70 years. And we combined all that information in a computer readable format and put it together and asked the question, well, is the metabolism that we collected, the metabolic information, representative to what we really know happens in a baby? And so where does it start? So on this digital baby, we can really give in now metabolic or metabolite composition information, for example, from the breast milk, give that to the baby in the mouse. And then in the computer model, these metabolites are taken up in the gastrointestinal tract, then go into the liver, and there they're either metabolized, so converted into other compounds, or transported into the blood and go then to peripheral organs, where they're then utilized, for example, to make the baby grow or to generate energy or to accumulate fat, or really provide the baby, the digital baby, with the energy needed for brain development.
Right. So in this model, you have a sort of a computer game in a way that mimics the metabolism of a baby. And if you put in a lot of infant milk, for example, or not enough, what do you see in the digital twin of the baby's metabolism?
So in our computer model, the way the models are set up, they have to produce enough energy to what we know is required for proper brain development, for the different activity states, for thermoregulation, so maintaining a body temperature, the work of the heart. So if you don't give enough milk, then the model will not grow, which is equal to the baby will not grow or will not gain enough weight from day to day. So that's the way the computational digital twins are parameterized, if you want.
I thought this digital baby stayed the same age, but by the sounds of it, this baby will grow like a real baby if you feed it over time. Is that correct?
Yes. So we have actually not generated only one digital baby, but we generated 360, so for male as well as female, over the time course of 180 days. So representing each of these models, the first 180 days. Wow. Of a baby to grow. And so we could show, for example, that the growth rate of the baby or the weight gain of the baby is consistent to what the WHO, the World Health Organization, would recommend. So really half a growing baby in the computer, if you want.
So you have a baby that will grow up to 6 months. And yeah. As you feed this digital baby food or not, or give it certain types of food, it will... You can see what happens to the energy output and the growth of that baby. How do you get all of that information into a model? I mean, it sounds like a huge amount of information required to be able to simulate something so complicated.
It is indeed. It is a lot of information. But surprisingly enough, the research being done, the information is available in scientific publications. And then, of course, we talked a lot also with pediatricians. So to get us really right and to understand what is different between baby metabolism at the different stages, but also in comparison to adult individuals, so that we could really make it specific for the individual days as a baby grows.
Are babies different physiologically? I mean, apart from their size, but does their body work the same way as an adult, for example? Are they just smaller?
So this is how we started off. We said, okay, babies are actually only small adults. And then we looked into the literature and we talked to the pediatricians and we realized, no, they're not. And much has to do with the fact that babies are growing. So the organs are growing, while most of the adult organs are not growing. They're maintaining themselves, but they do not grow. Maybe skin being an exception. And so that meant that we had to really encode that differently in the baby models. Another distinction is the thermoregulation, which I wasn't aware of either, that babies actually up to an age of 6 months can't shiver, so they can't maintain their body temperature.
Oh, and of like course I knew babies don't shiver when they're cold?
No, they don't. They can't do that. So they don't have this, I suppose, this mechanism yet built in. But in addition, the baby has actually a mechanism through the healthy fat, if you want. It's called brown fat. And to generate energy quickly through that and to maintain the body temperature.
Can I ask, is this clinically useful? Because obviously every baby is different. They have different genes. Those genes are expressed differently. There's other sorts of factors such as environment, which may have an impact on how much movement a baby gets, how much stimulation they get, how much food they might need. When you only have two models, how clinically useful is something like that?
So this is where our work continues to go on, is to demonstrate that there's actually clinical usage possible. And so one of the things that we can do with our digital twins, and that's why we also call it so, is that we can personalize that. And in the current study, we demonstrate that by taking blood metabolite composition information from 10,000 individuals or babies. And we overlaid that with a digital model that we have, and we computed for each of the babies how fast they could grow. And just to demonstrate that this could be done, so we can personalize the babies. We could, in principle, also personalize the babies based on their genetic makeup, as you said. And so we do that right now as a proof of principle by deleting certain genes that we know are affected in particular diseases, and those ones are generally inherited metabolic diseases. Mm. And we choose those ones because they go back to single gene deletions. So they're fairly straightforward in terms of simulations and analyzing afterwards the results. But they also have a very large clinical importance because these diseases are rare individually, and so they're at times difficult to diagnose. So that's a way how we would like to support clinical decision making and diagnosis down the road. So we're working on demonstrating that there's a clinical usage for these models.
Right. Is it possible now to sort of configure this digital baby that you have to be like a particular individual, for example, to see if the particular medicine would be consumed well, or a particular formulation of infant formula might be a good option for a baby that is, for example, undernourished or underweight?
You can do that. So the blood metabolites that I mentioned is one way of personalization. What we also used is birth weight. We have, of course, male and female infant models, so we can choose that. And then based on this information, we can basically parameterize the digital baby specific to a particular baby. And then if we know that this baby has a particular genetic defect, like it is, for example, the case with phenylketonuria, which is one of these more frequent inherited metabolic diseases, we can also delete the gene in the model. And then we can ask, well, if we were to give it a dietary treatment, for example, a phenylalanine-reduced milk, what would be the consequences? Would that actually reduce the known biochemical consequences of having this enzymatic defect? And right. So we can start testing therapeutic approaches in a personalized manner on these baby models.
And what about running that in reverse, for example? If you have a baby that is 6 months old, for example, and has certain problems with their metabolism, and you had a snapshot or you'd taken measurements of that baby at birth and at 3 months, is it possible to use this model to look back and try and untangle what may have happened to the baby to help diagnose some sort of pathology?
This is a great question, and it's actually a part of two distinct research projects that we're involved in to actually try to solve this backward problem. Yes, it is possible to do, but we have to do a little bit more work in figuring out the right algorithm that permits us to do that. Mm. But it's really where we would like to go is to, you know, take a baby's information, just as you described it, and make suggestions for a potential diagnosis.
Mm. Obviously, using AI and these enormous databases that we have when it comes to infant healthcare, presumably the, you know, the holy grail of something like this would be to have a digital twin that could link endocrinology with vasculature, with metabolism, and with all these different systems that work together to create a digital baby where you could really introduce all sorts of environments to see how it affected a child to really improve and predict outcomes for treatments. Is that 1,000 years away? Is it 5 years away? Is it 50 years away?
I'd say that's probably 5 to 10 years away.
Wow.
Well, I hope so. Also for the affected babies, really, and their families. I mean, AI keeps on astonishing us. Mm. And the speed on how things develop, so it might be even faster possible. It will depend on the disease. So the more data you have, the better AI works. And so our models are deterministic, so they're not based on machine learning per se. And so the problem with AI and many of the machine learning approaches is that you need a lot of data, and particularly for inherited metabolic diseases, which are individually rare, you might only have 5, 50, or 100 known cases worldwide.
Yeah.
It becomes very challenging, and I think there's a niche opportunity for the kind of models that we are building to help and add on to AI approaches that will be automatically used.
Yeah, I mean, 5 to 10 years seems both optimistic, but also not in a way. And who knows what these sort of digital twins of babies as they develop might do for predictive healthcare and for pathology and diagnostics. Really brilliant speaking with you, Professor Ines Thiele from the APC Microbiome in Ireland and University of Galway. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
I have 2 actual babies, and the idea of looking after another one, digital or no, would be just a step too far, to be honest.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.